Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
Mark, imagine you're appealing a government decision that's going to cost you $10,000. So you walk into the hearing room, and the person across from you who's making the decision works for the same agency that made the initial determination against you. And their boss, the person who signs their performance reviews, might be the very same person who approved that initial decision you're challenging.
That doesn't really sound like a neutral decision maker.
Probably not. So now imagine that you're appealing a different decision. You've also got $10,000 on the line. You walk into your hearing room, but this time, the person who's making the decision has tenure-like protections. The agency can't fire them for ruling against the agency. No one is tracking how often they side with the government, or at least not in a way that affects their job. And if there's ever a complaint about their conduct, it goes to a completely separate organization.
It sounds like an actual court.
Both of these are different types of federal administrative hearings, and both happen every day. In these scenarios, we've got the same amount of money at stake, but we're still dealing with completely different systems with completely different decision makers.
So how do you know which kind of judge you get? Does it depend on which agency you're in front of?
It depends on which agency, which program, which stage of the program you're at. These are all going to depend on the type of statute that Congress happened to write. Two people who are challenging the same dollar amount or who both have their livelihoods on the line can walk into completely different hearing rooms with completely different protections just because one owes money to the IRS and the other owes money to OSHA.
So that seems like it should violate equal protection or something like that.
Courts have said no. That Congress gets to design these systems, and Congress has designed dozens of them. Each has its own rules about who decides and how much independence they have and what happens if they rule against the agency. So today we are mapping that spectrum of judges, and then we'll talk about why the Supreme Court might be about to collapse all of it. We're going to start at the top of the independence pyramid. Administrative law judges are ALJs. But to understand why we would have ALJs, you have to understand what things looked like before.
So what was the problem Congress was trying to solve?
All right. So this is before the Administrative Procedure Act in 1946. And at that point in time, agency adjudications were often decided by whoever the agency happened to choose. There were no independence requirements. There were no standard procedures. The person deciding your case might report directly to the same people who brought the case against you.
And that doesn't sound much like due process.
It certainly didn't feel like it. Congress heard testimony from adjudicators who said they felt pressure to rule in favor of the agency. They heard testimony from people who were worried that the rulings they were doing against the agency could affect their performance review or their promotion or their job security. So the APA created a new category called hearing examiners, which were later renamed administrative law judges. These are ALJs. This is the gold standard. And I'd like you to read from the statutory section on ALJ independence.
This is from 5 U.S.C. 7521. An action may be taken against an administrative law judge by the agency in which the administrative law judge is employed only for good cause established and determined by the Merit Systems Protection Board.
So first, we have for cause removal protection. The agency can't fire an ALJ just because they don't like the decision. And that protection is enforced by an entirely separate body, the MSPB, not by the agency itself.
So what else protects their independence?
Historically, ALJs were hired through a competitive process that was run by OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, but that changed in 2018 for reasons we'll be talking about. They do have salary protections, so agencies can't cut their pay as punishment, and they can't be given performance reviews that might pressure them to rule in certain ways. They also can't be assigned other duties that would conflict with their job of judging.
Okay. But they still work for the agency, right? Their paychecks come from the agency.
Technically, yes. But things start to get a little complicated. So in 2018, the Supreme Court decided Lucia v. SEC. And the question there was whether the SEC ALJs are officers of the United States, which we care about because the Constitution's appointment clause says that officers have to be appointed by presidents, courts, or heads of department.
And SEC ALJs weren't appointed that way?
No, they were hired by SEC staff members like regular employees. So the court looked at what the ALJs actually did. They took testimony, they conducted trials, they ruled on the admissibility of evidence, they enforced compliance with discovery orders. Here's how the court described their authority.
They all have authority needed to ensure fair and orderly adversarial hearings, indeed nearly all of the tools of federal trial judges.
After this, they said that these ALJs are officers, they're not really employees. So that meant that their appointments had been unconstitutional.
Why does that classification matter beyond how they're hired?
Once you decide that somebody is an officer who's exercising executive power, a new question comes into focus, a question we've already talked about a little, which is, can Congress insulate that officer from presidential removal? Under the Constitution, officers exercise executive power, and executive power is supposed to be controlled by the president. So now we could have officers making decisions that the president can't override because these people have for-cause removal protections. And that is creating major constitutional tension.
So the very protections that make ALJs seem fair might be constitutionally vulnerable?
Yes. Keep that in mind as we work through this spectrum. We're going to try and make this concrete. The most common way that normal people encounter an ALJ is through Social Security disability determinations. And we're looking at this a little shows the strengths and the problems with the system.
Walk me through the process.
You apply for disability benefits. First thing, an agency employee who is not an ALJ, just a regular employee, reviews your file and probably denies you. Initial denial rates are probably over 60%. So you officially ask for reconsideration and a different agency employee reviews it, still not an ALJ, and that employee also probably denies you. And only at that point can you request a hearing before an ALJ.
So you have to lose twice before you can see someone that has any independence protections.
Yes. And here's where things start to get interesting and troubling. That ALJ approval rates vary enormously.
How much variation are we talking about?
About as much as you could imagine. Most ALJs are going to be somewhere in the middle. But there are some ALJs approving around 10% of cases, and others are approving over 90%. Same statute, same regulation, same definition of disability, but your outcome can depend heavily on which judge you happen to get.
That's an 80 percentage point swing on life-changing decisions.
Yes. The Wall Street Journal did an investigation and found one ALJ who had approved 98% of cases and another one who had approved less than 5%.
Isn't some variation inevitable? I mean, different judges will weigh different evidence differently. That happens in Article III courts, too.
Sure. It's a fair point. Not every judge is going to see identical cases. Geography matters. Claimants could matter. Docket composition could vary. But it's really hard to imagine a system where if the exact same person were deciding all of these decisions, that we would still have an 80-point spread. This looks like something beyond just normal judicial discretion. So this creates what I would call this independence paradox. We want ALJs to be free from agency pressure to deny claims. That's the whole point of these protections. But this independence also enables these kind of incredible disparities. And when you look at those, it starts to look less like fair adjudication and more like a judge lottery.
So then what's the fix?
That's the hard part. So more agency oversight might mean reduced disparities, but it would undermine independence, and it would also mean judges would probably be ruling in ways they didn't feel were actually correct. So more independence preserves fairness in individual cases and ensures that we're not denying somebody just because we need to meet a quota, but it allows these kind of great disparities to persist. There is really no clean solution.
You're not really giving us an answer.
No, I'm really not. This is genuinely difficult. And it's one reason that we keep circling back to these questions about ALJ independence, that the trade-offs are real. Now we're going to move a step down this independence spectrum to immigration judges. These IJs are called judges, again, immigration judges. They wear robes. They can run hearings that look like trials, but they are not ALJs. And that distinction can literally mean the difference between life and death for people.
What makes them structurally different?
Immigration judges are DOJ attorneys who work for something called EOIR, the Executive Office for Immigration Review. They don't have the same civil service protections as ALJs. The Attorney General can review and reverse their decisions, and they can be removed more easily.
What does that mean, though, in practice?
For a while, it meant they had actual production quotas. In 2018, the DOJ instituted a performance plan that required individual immigration judges to complete at least 700 cases a year and to keep their remand rate under 15% and meet a bunch of other benchmarks, all just to be rated satisfactory.
So 700 cases in a year, that's roughly 3 cases per working day.
Yes. And if you're thinking, well, if I were running this, I could probably do 3 hearings in a day. That doesn't sound that much. This is the time to review the file, to conduct the hearing, to do everything you need to do after it, to write up the decisions, all of it, 3 of those a day. And each one of those was potentially determining whether someone gets deported to a country where they face persecution. And there's probably a reasonable likelihood they do, or their case would have been thrown out much earlier. Immigration judges described being pressured to rush through hearings, to limit testimony, to decide cases without fully developing the record, all to try and hit these numbers.
So is that system still in place?
It is not. It didn't last very long. In 2021, these individual quotas were revoked, but what replaced them were court-level performance metrics. So now they're not measuring each judge, but they are measuring each court. There are timeliness benchmarks for detained cases, for asylum cases, for motions, custody hearings. But they did explicitly state in 2025 that they are not reinstating individualized performance measures for immigration judges at the present time.
So the pressure shifted from individual judges to courts as institutions.
Yeah, that 700 case quota is gone, but there are still structural pressures. Courts are still measured on speed, and when your court is being evaluated on how fast it clears cases, that pressure flows downhill to the judges, even without a number attached to their personal performance review.
So what's the current situation?
There is a huge backlog. It was over 4 million cases at the start of 2025. The administration has been very aggressively clearing cases through a variety of means, and it had completed over 722,000 in fiscal year 2025 so far. This was the highest single-year total in the agency's history, and that dropped the pending caseload to about 3.4 million.
So it sounds like progress being made.
Yeah, kind of. It depends on how you measure it. A lot of these completions were just in absentia removals. The people didn't show up for their hearing, and therefore they lost. Through the first 9 months of fiscal year 2025, immigration judges issued over 200,000 in absentia removal orders. So that was more than 24,000 a month, which was about a 30% increase over last year.
So cases are being completed by deporting people who weren't there to defend themselves.
Yes. And here's the structural paradox. While the administration says it wants to speed up deportations, it's also been firing immigration judges. There were about 700 immigration judges at the start of 2025. By November, they'd already lost more than 125 to firings and voluntary resignations.
So they're firing judges while claiming the backlog is the problem.
Yeah. So they said the judges weren't managing their caseloads efficiently, but there had been a bunch of extra money allocated to the Justice Department for immigration-related activities, like hiring judges. So instead, judges were being terminated. And they're being terminated in ridiculous ways, sometimes in the middle of hearings. They could be pulled off the bench mid-hearing, told they were fired, and escorted out of the building.
With no explanation?
No, none given. And I would just like to point out that if what we're trying to do is clear cases, stopping in the middle of a hearing is not an efficient way we're going to clear cases. But what makes this directly relevant to what we're talking about is these immigration judges don't have the same removal protections that ALJs have. The attorney general can fire them right in the middle of a hearing. And so that's exactly what's happening. They're being removed. Those with backgrounds in immigrant defense are being disproportionately affected. And now the administration has authorized 600 military lawyers to serve as temporary immigration judges and also eliminated the prior requirement for immigration law experience.
And of course, there's no right to appointed counsel because it's technically civil.
Right. Even though the Supreme Court has said that deportation is intimately related to the criminal process, it is a civil procedure. And so the Sixth Amendment protections don't apply. This means that children can appear in immigration courts without lawyers. People with severe mental illness can be appearing without lawyers. There were maybe a quarter of immigrants who had any sort of attorney when a removal order was issued against them by the end of 2025.
So you have judges with less independence, judges being fired without explanation, a massive backlog, in absentia orders skyrocketing, military lawyers with no immigration experience being brought in as replacements, and no guaranteed representation for the people whose lives are at stake.
Yeah, that seems to about sum it up. Part of this is just the basic structural problem we've created, that the agency prosecuting you and the judge deciding your case are both part of the executive branch. The judge does not have the same kind of independence protections that we talked about. And so thinking about this, immigration judge associations for years have tried to create some sort of independent immigration court, move it out of the Department of Justice entirely, make it an Article I court like the tax court, which is technically housed within the judiciary, not within the executive branch. But that hasn't happened. So what we're seeing now is exactly what happens when adjudicators lack structural independence. The administration can reshape the bench to match its priorities. But now you can look at a system that sits somewhere in the middle of this independent spectrum. IRS appeals. It's not as protected as an ALJ adjudication, but it has some features that make it different from regular agency decision-making.
Okay, what's the setup?
When the IRS takes collection action against you, like filing a lien on your property or preparing to levy your bank account, you have certain rights to challenge that action. One of the most important is the collection due process hearing, or CDP hearing.
Who hears those?
There are settlement officers and appeals officers in what's called the Independent Office of Appeals. Here's how the IRS describes their role.
Appeals is an independent function within the IRS, completely separate from the compliance functions responsible for collecting and assessing taxes. Appeals provides an informal forum for taxpayers who disagree with an IRS determination. Our job is to resolve tax disputes without litigation, where possible, consider each case fairly and impartially.
So notice there's an emphasis on independent and separate. That language matters. It's trying to signal that the person reviewing your case isn't the same person who decided to come after you in the first place.
But they're still all IRS employees.
Yes, they still are. We're talking about over 1,000 people. These are mostly appeals officers and settlement officers. But what makes the system different here is that they have strict structural protections for independence. So first, there was a 1998 Restructuring Act where they were prohibited from ex parte communication with other IRS employees, which means they couldn't do back channel conversations about your case without you present. And second, for collection due process hearings, it requires that the appeals officer have had no prior involvement with that specific tax liability.
So the person deciding my appeal can't be the same person who audited me.
Right. And the settlement officer deciding the CDP hearing also can't call up the revenue officer who put a lien on your house and say, hey, what's your read on this guy? They have to decide based on what's in the file and what you present to them.
So what does a CDP hearing actually look like then?
It'll usually be conducted by phone or correspondence, sometimes by video. You can present documentation, explain your circumstances, propose alternatives, maybe think about some sort of installment agreement or an offer where you settle for less than you owe.
And if you lose?
So here's where there's a real potential advantage over other agency processes. You get to take your case to tax court. The IRS has to give you a notice of determination explaining your decision, and then you have 30 days to petition for judicial review.
So there's actually a path to an Article III court.
Well, there's a path to an Article I court, the tax court, but this is real judicial review. That's unusual. And that's partly because, again, that Article I tax court isn't within the executive branch, it's within the judiciary. Most agency adjudication processes don't give you that direct an access to an independent court.
So we've got informal hearings, but with judicial review at the end. Okay. So what's the catch? How are they really different from than ALJs?
First, they don't have the removal protections that ALJs have. They're career civil servants, but they just have normal civil servant job protection. They don't have special insulation. Second, there are over 130,000 appeals a year with just these 1,200 employees. So you could say resources are a bit stretched. Third, it's independent within the IRS, but it's still within the IRS. The culture, the institutional pressures, the career incentives, They're all in the same building.
So it's better than nothing, but not quite neutral.
Yes, it is a genuine attempt at internal independence. And it looks like probably 40% of the cases are resolved, at least partially in the taxpayer's favor, which is meaningful. But it's not the same as having your case heard by somebody who has no institutional connection to the agency that's trying to collect from you. But now we're going to circle back to that constitutional tension we flagged at the beginning. Lucia said that ALJs are officers of the United States, which means they have to be appointed in accordance with the Appointments Clause.
Which already moves them closer to presidential control.
Yes. And once we've classified somebody as an officer exercising executive power, then we can look at how can Congress insulate that officer from presidential removal.
The removal power question from season one.
Yes. So these are also likely to fall the same way many removal protections are about to fall. But since we don't have an actual decision yet, let's read you what the court has been thinking about how this constitutional framework applies. This is from the court's opinion in Celia Law.
The president's removal power has long been confirmed by history and precedent. It was discussed extensively in Congress when the first executive departments were created in 1789.
The court is trying to ground this in the founding generation's understanding of the Constitution.
And then they go on to say, just as the president's selection of administrative officers is essential to the execution of the laws by him, so must be his power of removing those for whom he cannot continue to be responsible. To hold otherwise, the court reasoned, would make it impossible for the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
So when they say that, they're quoting Myers, the 1926 case. And then he connects it back to the modern era.
And they say, we recently reiterated the president's general removal power and free enterprise fund. Since 1789, we recapped, the Constitution has been understood to empower the president to keep these officers accountable by removing them from office, if necessary. Free enterprise fund left in place only two exceptions to the president's unrestricted removal power.
So that was two exceptions. Multi-member commissions like the FTC, which, again, we don't expect to be around for much longer, and inferior officers with limited duties like the independent counsel. Everyone else serves at the president's pleasure. You can see the court is increasingly skeptical of arrangements that try to place any sort of executive power beyond presidential supervision. We talked about this before with independent agencies. Same logic applies to independent adjudicators.
So even though the court hasn't ruled directly on ALJ removal.
Yeah, the trajectory is clear. If we're going to go with the unitary executive theory, and that says the president must be able to supervise all executive officers, and ALJs are executive officers, then deep insulation from removal becomes harder, if not impossible, to justify.
So if ALJs lost for-cause protection, what would actually happen?
It would mean that Social Security could fire ALJs if their approval rates were too high. The SEC could remove ALJs who ruled against the enforcement action too often. Agencies could pressure judges to align with policy priorities, maybe not through explicit orders, but through the inherent implicit threat that comes with at-will employment.
So adjudicators would face pressure to rule the way the agency wants them to rule.
Exactly, which is exactly what the 1946 APA was designed to prevent. We'd be back to that pre-APA world where the person deciding your case worries about what the agency thinks of the decision.
The features that make ALJs fair are the same features that make them constitutionally vulnerable.
Yes, and the court hasn't officially said it yet, but there are about 2,000 ALJs across the federal government, and they are deciding hundreds of thousands of cases every year. And when the court, what seems like nearly inevitably, says that that level of independence violates the separation of powers,
then the system shifts towards more presidential control, more agency supervision, and adjudication that looks a lot less like judging. So here's what I'm taking away. We want adjudicators to be independent so they can be fair, but we also want consistency, accountability, and constitutional compliance. Those goals can and seemingly often conflict.
Yes. Too much independence, and we can get these 80-point approval rate disparities. Too little independence, and we have hearing officers who are afraid to rule against their own agency, even if they think that's what the case really calls for. And now we have the Supreme Court questioning whether Congress can even give adjudicators any insulation from presidential control.
The whole spectrum seems like it's under pressure.
Yes, from multiple directions. As the court continues in its current direction, we can expect to see significant changes in how federal adjudication works across the board.
What's next then?
Now that we've talked about who these judges are, how they're currently protected or not protected, we have to look at a different question. What happens when the same agency that's investigating you is the agency judging you? What about when the prosecutor and judge work for the same boss? What does that actually mean? That's next time.
That sounds like a due process problem.
It might be. Or this might just be an acceptable feature of administrative efficiency. We will dig into it.
So that does it for today's episode on administrative remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.